Broadcasting worldwide from the beautiful hill country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone. How are you? We're going to trip the light fandango all about the body today. We're going to get into some nutrition this morning and more of it next hour with Dr. Stuart Ross. Talk about neurotransmitters in the brain and cognitive function and see if we can make a little sense out of these things we are known as diseases, ADHD and Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, those kinds of things, and get some ideas on how that won't happen. That'd be a nice thing to do. It is the 11th of October, 2011, and it's a Tuesday morning. We're live every morning, OneRadioNetwork.com, and also on NaturalNewsRadio.com. Tomorrow, Andrew Goss, the real world of money, and after Andrew, we're going to be speaking with a lady who's very involved in the whole genetically modified organization, or genetically modified organisms, I should say, and trying to get those labeled in California. The perfect health diet on Thursday. And what else we got on Thursday? Oh, yeah. An interesting man I came across who is a natural OBGYN for you OBGYN fans and babies and girls and women stuff, and he'll be on. So we got a lot of things on health this week. We generally do focus on health, wealth, and well-being, which covers anything that we come up with, which is kind of cool. If you'd like to be on the show this morning, you're always welcome to do it. Our phone lines are always open worldwide. 888-663-6386. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. If you'd like to talk with our guest and you live overseas, it's 001-888-663-6386. We're going to go up to Connecticut and visit with a gentleman who is just this short of his PhD in nutritional sciences. And he's a concentration on biochemical and molecular nutrition, University of Connecticut. He's published peer-reviewed papers, which are indexed for PubMed here. And his focus is on vitamin A. Vitamin A is found in most abundantly in liver, food demonized by the American Heart Association and it for its rich in cholesterol content. He's got a great website, well-researched, it looks like, Cholesterol and Health. com. His name is Chris Masterjohn. Mr. Masterjohn, good morning.
Mr. Timpone, thank you so much for having me. Good morning to you.
Yeah. You're about to get your PhD, huh? Boy, they're going to be calling you doctor. Then what?
Oh, then I'm off to Illinois to do some postdoctoral research, and the fight goes on.
And the fight goes on. How long have you been at this, Mr. Masterjohn?
How long I've been at what? The nutrition?
The nutrition game, yeah.
Yeah, well, I've been eating all my life, and it was really when I was an undergraduate, I had a lot of health problems because, of course, you know, through my teenage years, my diet was never that great. And I became relatively health conscious, but I went vegetarian at that point, and that didn't go well for me at all. So I really had a lot of positive experiences in my later undergraduate years turning my health around. And soon after that, I wanted to, you know, share what I'd learned to help other people. So I started thinking about medical school. A lot of people encouraged me to go into nutritional research instead. So as soon as I graduated in 2003, I started taking a lot of science classes so I could get into a graduate program. And then it was in January of 2008 that I started the program.
Oh, it takes that long to get a PhD.
Well, it takes that long when you've got a lot of other things to do besides take classes.
Besides, like, support yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. 888-663-6386 if you have a question. This fellow's done a massive amount of research on nutrition. I'm curious, it may seem like a dumb question, but when you're in university level and you're looking at nutritional research, how can you pick apart, Chris Masterjohn, of what is jammed in there from the people who support the universities and the drug companies and the pharmaceutical companies? You know, how can you figure out what the heck you're getting is real?
Well, I think it depends what you're looking at. I mean, you know, in what I do, conduct my own experiments, I read the scientific literature and so on, and, you know, it's always possible that the scientific studies that you're reading in the literature have, you know, some problems with them, but I think that most often the problems are interpretive. So, you know, people generate data and then they try to fit their data into their preconceived ideas. So you might read a study and the conclusions of the authors might, you know, be largely kind of trying to pigeonhole their own data into their own preconceived ideas, but the data is still there. So you can still, you know, take that data and synthesize it in your own way and understand it in your own way. Now, that's not to say that there's never any fraud in research. That certainly happens, but I think it's much, much more common that people are actually generating real data, and the most of the flaws come on the interpretive part of it.
Uh-huh. And where does the real data come from? Is it in the university level science?
Where does the real data come from?
Mr. Masterjohn, that you believe is really authentic information, say in your line of nutrition? Where is that scientific research done?
Well, I mean, I'm mostly involved in the university setting, so most of the research that I'm doing, and probably the greater portion of the research out there in the literature, is also done in universities. You might see a lot of other research done in, you know, a hospital setting if it's a clinical study, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And that, in general, tends to be, what, in your opinion, what your experience has been, independent, unbiased?
You always have funding sources. So you always have expectations. And but, you know, in addition to the funding sources and expectations, you have just as much of someone wanting to prove their own point or support their own hypothesis or try to make their new study fit in with their old study or simply try to, you know, publish only the things that they can explain. So, you know, someone measures 10 or 15 things in a study and they all seem to conflict with one another, they might, you know, select 5 of those to publish in their paper and then knows the better. So, no, I don't think that anything is independent, because even if you have someone who's working with their own money, then they still have their own ideas. So, you know, the data that people are producing and publishing is never independent, is never truly independent, because it's at least dependent on the investigator's own biases, not only in what they're reporting, but even what they're investigating. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you think about how vast the world is, you know, there are plenty of things that we want to investigate and can't just because of the nature of the problem. But how much of what we know about the world is limited just by the things that we're asking, you know, the questions that we ask? What are the possible questions that are out there, and what are the ones that we've asked? It could be that the questions we're asking is 0.0001% of the questions that could be asked.
Yeah.
So I think all of the data out there is very dependent on many many sources of bias.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think in particularly of this whole genetically modified GMO issue, and you'll hear the politicians say, "Well, we're going to wait on the science on that before we really make a decision." That kind of thing, and the arguments against labeling, and then you think, how could you ever really do scientific project on that? Well, how many people would you have to get and have them just eat only genetically modified food maybe for 20, 30, 40 years and then get same amount of people only eat maybe organic food?
Well, I think the genetically modified food area is much worse than many areas, other areas of science. I think there's a sort of concerted effort to make anyone who even wants to ask those questions appear as a total quack.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people. I saw an article in Nature, I think it was, where people, some scientists, questioned the doctrine of substantial equivalency, which is, say, you genetically engineer a corn plant, and then you do a minimal amount of tests to prove that the new plant is corn, and then you say, well, corn's been recognized as safe, so this is corn, so therefore it must be safe. And these researchers had presented a number of arguments about why this doctrine is flawed and why real studies should be done on these foods. And there were people who wrote a letter and called them conspiracy theorists. And they didn't have any conspiracy theories at all. They just said, look, this doctrine is rather unscientific and we should investigate the matter. And so, you know, conspiracy theory is you know, one of those epithets that people just use to say, oh, you must be a quack. Mm-hmm. So I think that genetic engineering is kind of a sacred cow that people just aren't allowed to touch.
Yeah, it's pretty big, isn't it? And there's so much money involved and... we interviewed Armand Poutsay. Have you ever heard of him, Mr. Master John? He did a massive amount of... Yeah, and I don't even know if he's still around. I know that they really roughed him up for doing the work that he did. But his bottom line was that after many years of looking at this in deep science, that these foods just simply were not recognizable. This was his findings by the human body and thus undigestible. So... You know, it's a big issue, isn't it? It's and now it's difficult to even get labeling. We're going to do a show tomorrow. People just out there in California just fighting for the ability to label a food that's been genetically modified.
Yeah, well, you know, whenever there's opposition to labeling, then you can you know that someone really just doesn't want other people to know important information about what they're buying, and it's never a good sign.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you had a stint as a vegetarian, and it didn't go well. I'm wondering, there's always this back and forth with the meat eating and vegetarian, probably will be until the end of the earth, and there's always going to be this kind of, you know, back and forth, you know, what's best, what is your experience as far as each individual's uniqueness, whether it be their genetic predisposition, their ancestral diet, if you can use that term, blood type and things like that, and determining what are some of the best foods for their body. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not quite convinced that blood type is going to be the be-all, end-all of figuring out how you're going to eat. But I definitely think that, you know, any theory of health has to accept that there's variation between people and their different responses to diet. And I mean, you can just look around and you see that there's biological variation just in how people look. You know, we wouldn't be able to recognize each other as individuals if our faces didn't look different. So to not believe that there are also differences in how we respond to diet, I think, is incredibly simplistic. And you know, in my personal experience, I had tooth decay, anxiety disorders, digestive problems, and all sorts of things that occurred when I was a vegetarian. And certainly, there, you know, looking back on it, if I were to do vegetarianism again, knowing what I know now, there are ways I could have improved it. But I was trying to be health conscious, and I still ran into these health problems. And many of the most dramatic changes I saw occurred relatively quickly after simply introducing red meat into my diet. And then, you know, I improved my diet beyond that and included organ meats and a variety of other nutrient-dense foods and obtained even more success. But it's, you know, it's quite clear that not everyone experiences those problems on a vegetarian diet. And even among those who do experience problems, you know, other people might experience different problems from the one that I did. So I think that we need to look at theory about nutrition and use that as a starting point to try to understand how we should eat. But then we really need to tailor our own diets to our own experience. And if something sounds good on paper, or when we hear it from someone else and we put it into practice and things aren't working well, then we just need to change that. And I think that we need to not get wrapped up too much in arguments about, you know, for example, vegetarianism or really any other matter. We can't turn it into a matter of doctrine, because the fact is that if someone else in their experience is doing fantastically on a vegetarian diet, then who am I to argue with them about why they're deluding themselves? It's just silly. So I think we need to get to a point where we recognize that different people respond differently. But, you know, I think we also have to recognize, even in our own selves, that there may be variations over time in what we need for a diet. Just because something's working for me now doesn't mean it's going to work for me 3 years from now. And that could be because my circumstances and needs change, or it could be because I'm correcting some imbalance that took 3 or 4 years to develop. You know, if, you know, I might have developed certain nutrient deficiencies that I need to spend quite a while correcting, and then maybe they'll be corrected and I need to return to a different balance. So I think we always need to keep an open mind about what our needs will be and what the needs of other people will be.
Yeah, fair enough. Well said. 17 after the hour, Chris Masterjohn. He's moments away from his, months away from his PhD in nutritional science there up in Connecticut. If you care to join us, 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Also broadcasting live every morning. And happy to be on naturalnews.com, naturalnewsradio.com. Also check out alternativenews.com, a spinoff that Mike Adams has done. And it's quite a fun website. We can click on there and look at all different areas of life and get some pretty cool stuff that Mike has gathered from around the world. Kind of a one-stop shopping. I go there regularly, find all kinds of fun things. Alternativenews.com. So it's interesting. I think we've all gone through periods where we'll look at a food and it'll be in the fridge and we've been eating it a lot, and then all of a sudden we just don't want it. And I think it's a blessing if we can get to that point where we have this deep intuitive feeling, not in the head, you know, not saying, boy, I'd sure like some Häagen-Dazs because I remember how good that is, but you know what I mean? I'd say, we just look at it and you say, I just don't want that pork chop right now. I'm really going to go for a green juice or something. This is what I need. That's a nice place to get to, isn't it?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a role for intuition and listening to our bodies. And, you know, I imagine that our cravings are, you know, very adaptive when we're not living in a world where we have so many destructive choices at our fingertips that we never had before.
That
craving for Häagen-Dazs might either not have existed had we not been raised on the Häagen-Dazs, or it might be, you know, an underlying craving that we would interpret in a different way if all we had available to us were natural foods. But I think ultimately those cravings are probably things that we're supposed to be listening to in some way.
Hmm. I know that one of your specialties you really write a lot about, and it's quite interesting, is the whole vitamin A thing and cholesterol and the cholesterol, the myth that's been around cholesterol. And we've certainly done some shows on that. And your website is called cholesterolandhealth.com. And of course, you know, to this day, the great majority of docs will go in there and take your cholesterol. And if it's 180, they'll give you a statin drug and try to get it down to 120. Those kinds of things. I'm wondering, This all started really with the Framingham cholesterol thing. I remember, didn't it, back in the 70s?
Well, I think it really depends where you want to start your analysis. I mean, certainly it took quite a long time to get rolling, but we could go back to the cholesterol-fed rabbit in 1913 if we wanted to really see the roots of this controversy. But certainly it didn't really start picking up steam until the 1970s and 80s, and it was really 1984 when the NIH declared that the deal had been sealed and that, in fact, lowering blood cholesterol was the path to preventing heart disease. But, yeah, if we go back to the cholesterol-fed rabbit, I mean, of course, the rabbit is an herbivore, and, you know, you can't expect the rabbit necessarily to have the same dietary response as a human. And no one experimenting with the cholesterol-fed rabbit model ever thought that you could actually make that generalization. But they were just trying basically everything they could in rabbits to try to understand what causes heart disease. And they were trying, you know, they did all sorts of experiments, hanging the rabbits upside down by their feet and damaging their kidneys in order to increase their blood pressure, injecting them with bacteria and bacterial toxins and heavy metals and various hormones and nicotine and caffeine. They directly damaged blood vessels with galvanized wire, and they did all sorts of things to these rabbits, and they couldn't produce something that looked like human atherosclerosis. But when they started feeding them fatty foods, the cholesterol levels in their blood went skyrocketed. And they eventually narrowed it down to the cholesterol. If they purified cholesterol, they could achieve the same thing. And these actually produced plaques that looked quite similar in many respects to human atherosclerosis. And that was really the beginning of the theory. But even then, the evidence was clear that it wasn't cholesterol causing the problem, because they could inject the rabbits with cholesterol. And naturally, if you inject them with cholesterol, of course their blood cholesterol skyrockets. But injecting them with cholesterol didn't cause these atherosclerotic plaques. So this was really key evidence that cholesterol itself is not the cause of heart disease. And I think that if we look over time, what we've seen is in these animal models, what's happening is that when you feed the animal cholesterol, it gets packaged into lipoproteins, and these lipoproteins are accumulating in the blood, but it's not their high concentration that's driving the atherosclerotic plaque. It's that when they get trapped in the blood, then they are vulnerable to oxidation, and oxidation is largely driven by oxidants, and oxidants are generated by inflammation, metabolic abnormalities, and toxic factors. And so what we really have is this horrible situation in these animal models, and I think in humans, where the lipids in our blood are getting attacked by all these oxidants, and that's what's really driving the process. So we really should see these lipids in our blood as victims rather than perpetrators.
So if you have your share of cholesterol, and the body makes its own cholesterol, of course, and we'll talk about that. So these lipids get oxidated by inflammation, metabolic things, and toxic things. So that could be a number of things. You could have a virus, bacteria. What do you mean, Mr. Master John, by metabolic and toxic? Talk a little bit about that. How does that affect the oxidation of these lipids?
Sure. So, in terms of metabolism as a source of oxidants, our basic goal whenever we burn fuel for energy is to break down the carbon-rich energy molecules. So, for example, glucose, a carbohydrate, a fatty acid, any of these molecules that we're going to burn for energy are all basically strings or rings of carbon and hydrogen. And in carbohydrate, we have some oxygen, too. In any case, we're trying to break down these carbon units and trying to harvest the electrons from them and zap those the energy out of those electrons. And then we can use that energy for our own body processes. In doing this, we take these electrons down to our mitochondria, which are often called the powerhouse of our cell. And this is where we harvest the energy from those electrons, and then we synthesize ATP, which is an energy currency for the cell. So it's sort of like having dollars in our wallet. This is small units of energy that we can use very quickly at any time. So we can store that energy in a way as ATP. Mm-hmm. Well, when we do this, we generate small amounts of oxidants. And oxidants are basically molecules that are capable of damaging other molecules. And if energy is running smoothly and efficiently, then we generate only tiny quantities of these oxidants. But if there are reasons that our energy metabolism is backed up, and that could be deficiencies of coenzyme Q10 or B vitamins, it could be deficiencies of certain hormones like thyroid hormone, or it could just be that it could be a deficiency of oxygen if the oxygen is not getting to the right places in our circulation, for example, or it could just be that we're eating massive quantities of food that's way beyond what our cells can handle at any given point. So maybe our appetite is dysregulated and we're consuming too much food. Any of these things can tip the scales where our energy isn't processed efficiently. And when it's not processed efficiently, that generates lots of oxidants. So we've already listed at least 10 possible causes of this problem.
So then this oxidation is what will cause the inflammation, and hence then the cholesterol tries to patch up the inflammation? Or is that too simplistic?
It can go both ways. Oxidation can cause inflammation, and inflammation can cause oxidation.
Okay, so, I see.
What you tend to have here is a vicious cycle.
I see. And then is it true then that the cholesterol, it tries to really paste up or repair these inflamed arteries, and then they cut open the arteries and they find the cholesterol, as they did in Framingham, I suppose, and say that these are the culprits. But as one person says, just because they were found at the scene of the crime doesn't mean they were the perpetrator.
That's one theory that's floated out there. I don't really agree with it.
Oh, yeah. So which one do you, what do you think the way it is?
The way that I envision this process and the role of cholesterol is like this. So when we eat cholesterol or when we synthesize it within our own body, we tend to carry it around in lipoproteins in the blood.
Right.
And the lipoproteins are, for example, low-density lipoprotein, which is LDL, high-density lipoprotein, which is HDL. These lipoproteins are not cholesterol. They're like carriers for the cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't just carry cholesterol. They also carry fats. They carry fat-soluble vitamins and all kinds of things that we need. So the purpose of these lipoproteins, and they may play other roles in the body too, I'm not denying that, but one of the purposes of these lipoproteins is to transport these fat-soluble nutrients, including cholesterol, from one place to another. And the problem is that in these lipoproteins, you can imagine them being kind of like a ball. So they're spherical shaped, like imagine a baseball. And you have in the membrane, so you have this membrane coating the ball, you have fatty acids, including polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are ones that are very vulnerable to oxidation, and we have proteins. And the fatty acids are constituents of molecules called phospholipids, and their main function is to make this fat-soluble ball able to be transported in the water-soluble blood. So they're like the interface. And you can almost, if you think of a bus or a car transporting people, then like the cholesterol and the fat-soluble vitamins, these are all the passengers on the bus. These fatty acids are kind of like the tires on the wheels, because they're what's able, they're what enables the bus to be able to drive on the road. It's that interface of contact with the road. And you can imagine that the blood is this, the bloodstream is this road that you're traveling down. And the protein is kind of like the driver of the bus. The protein is what tells the lipoprotein to go where it needs to go. Now, the problem is that in this membrane, these fatty acids and protein are very, very vulnerable to oxidation. So what we need to happen is to have this bus, so to call it, get to where it needs to go, get to its destination rather quickly. And we need to have it loaded up with all its protective factors, and we need to minimize all of the oxidants it might encounter. But when the bus isn't getting to where it needs to go because there's some sort of traffic jam, then it's going to interact with oxidants more. Or if there's just lots of oxidants because of the metabolic abnormalities or the inflammation we were just talking about, then it'll interact with oxidants more. And if we don't consume enough antioxidants, that is, there's not enough protection loaded on that bus, then that can contribute to the problem too. So the cholesterol is in the blood precisely because it's trying to get somewhere. It's trying to go from one cell to another, from one tissue to another. It needs to get where it's supposed to go. And when we have this damage happening to the lipoprotein, then the way that I see this formation of the atherosclerotic plaque is that these damaged lipids are really dangerous. They're kind of like toxic waste or broken glass. Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine if you have broken glass on the floor, you want to clean it up, right? Because you could step on it. You could hurt your foot. It's very dangerous. If you have toxic waste somewhere, you know, they create a Superfund site. They try to clean it up and at a minimum separate that toxic waste from other people. Well, when you have these damaged lipids in the blood, those damaged lipids are dangerous, and they can damage the blood vessels. So what I see happening is the immune system is coming along and creating that plaque in order to sort of quarantine those damaged lipids and to protect them from interacting with the blood vessels. So I don't really see, in my view, the cholesterol isn't in that plaque because the cholesterol is trying to patch up the blood vessel. The cholesterol is in that plaque because it happened to be at the site of the crime, and it was an innocent victim at most, but the immune system has taken all these lipids together and put them in a safe place. That's the way I see it.
Put them in a safe, interesting. And then the trans fats and the damaged lipids, are some of the causes of those? I mean, the damaged lipids, what we know as trans fats, which would be highly heated poly oils like soy oil and these things that you get at fast food places, French fries, of course, those kinds of things. Is that what one of the causes of the damaged lipids?
Right. So the sources of damage for the lipids are any type of oxidants, and we can call this general process oxidative stress. So like we were saying before, one of the causes is metabolic problems. Another is inflammation, and consuming heated oils and consuming hydrogenated oils can both contribute to that oxidative stress because these foods are sources of oxidants, and they are also sources of, in the case of trans fats, there's some evidence that they might interfere with the normal body processes and could contribute to producing more oxidants within our own bodies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Stay right there. Interesting. Chris Masterjohn, cholesterolandhealth.com, cholesterolandhealth.com. If you care to be on the show, we have lines available, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We're going to talk about the brain next hour with Dr. Stuart Ross and neurotransmitters and such. And so stay right there. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. If you've managed to put too much weight on over the years and have got yourself some of this kind of brown fat or the fat around the middle, they call it gray fat, aptos tissue kind of thing. It's pretty rough. It's tough to get rid of. Folks have had some wonderful success with HCG. And Michael Payne, who we're working with Living Well Today, he's doing an HCG homeopathic diet program where it's not the shots, HCG, but it's homeopathic. And it's a pretty strict diet, 1,000 calories a day, but meat and vegetables and stuff and no carbs. And people have lost a tremendous amount of weight doing this program for 30, 45 days. And the HCG will help you to not be hungry, and you do pretty good on 1,000 calories. This is a little bit more than the original Simeon's diet where they did the HCG shots and there was only 500 calories. This is 1,000, and the HCG seems to work just as well, and I would argue it's safer, and it's a lot easier to do. You don't have to inject yourself. And this program is a whole lot less, and if you go to your local doctor who's doing these HCG programs, they'll charge you $1,500. And I think this is $390 in that range. But you can click on the front page of One Radio Network, Living Well Today International. See the gal there in the blue bikini thing? And just click on that and let your fingers do the walking and call if you want more information. They have a number there. Or you can click an order and you could get down 20, 30 pounds depending on your situation. 15, 20, 30 pounds. And once again, everybody's different. Between now and December 15th, 45 days. Kind of interesting concept. So check it out right on the front page, oneradionetwork.com. And we've known Michael for a lot of years. He's a good guy, and I think you'll like this. Here's health motivator Daniel Vitalis and the benefits of using a far infrared sauna.
Sweating is absolutely going to be one of the most critical things discerning people take on so that they can not only stay healthy, but actually so we can continue to have children that are healthy. We're going to need to sweat. People have sweat all through history. Before the world was toxic, they used that for their health. Now that it's toxic, it's one of the only ways we're going to cleanse our body fat. Our body fat is where we store so much of the environmental pollution. Not just the radioactive elements, we're talking about PCBs, we're talking about plastics, we're talking about a host of pesticides and herbicides, we're talking about heavy metals. Getting this stuff out of our bodies, we're going to need to sweat it out.
And a fast, easy, and affordable way to sweat is with a portable, relax, far infrared sauna. See all the information. Order with promo code ONERADIO on OneRadioNetwork.com, a relaxed, portable, far infrared sauna on OneRadioNetwork.com. Well, the weather broke here, and we're getting down to 60, 55 at night in central Texas. And so the last two or three days, I've been jumping in my far infrared sauna for 20, 30 minutes. And boy, do you sweat. These are really nice machines. One radio code, you'll get it for $935 delivered via FedEx. I don't think you'll find a far infrared sauna at this price, not one that works like this one does. Really well engineered. When you click add there on our front page, you'll see a huge amount of information. Do all the research, and this would be a great thing to do two, three, four times, or just depending on how much you want to do this winter, wherever you are, front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.
At USGoldCoins.com, we hear from investors on a regular basis who express concerns about the future economy of the United States. They worry that the money that they've worked hard to earn might lose buying power if it were positioned in the wrong asset class. One of the best ways to preserve one's wealth is to acquire physical gold and silver coins. USGoldCoins.com provides exactly that product, physical gold and silver coins, sent directly to you as an investor. If this is not part of your portfolio yet, please give us a call today, 1-800-878-2646, so we can explore the possibilities with you and go over the benefits of acquiring gold and silver coins. You can log on the web at usgoldcoins.com or call us toll-free, 1-800-878-2646. We'll be glad to guide you and provide you with the best in gold and silver coins.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com. Talk to Patrick now. 888-663-6386. Or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
Oh, I forgot to do the gold and silver prices like we usually do. Everything's about steady as she goes. Not much going on gold and silver. Pretty steady here. The dollar is up a little bit after taking a beating yesterday. Crude oil is also not doing much. Quiet day thus far. And let's take a look at the markets here. And yeah, everything's kind of steady as she goes in Europe. What did they do today? My computer will work. Oh, well, we'll forget about that for the moment. Oh, they're down a little bit. We're with Chris Masterjohn, cholesterolandhealth.com, cholesterolandhealth.com. He's months away, just a few months from his PhD in nutritional sciences, has done massive amount of research on nutrition, health, especially vitamin A, cholesterol, those kinds of things. Let's take this call here. Hi, what's your first name? Where are you calling from? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Debbie. Hi.
Hi, Deb.
Hey, Chris.
Hi, Debbie.
Mr. Masterjohn.
Mr. Masterjohn?
I really, you guys haven't talked about this yet, but I really enjoyed Chris's, well, first of all, his talk at AHS, Ancestral Health Symposium on cholesterol was excellent. But the thing I wanted to ask about was your series on the Maasai.
Uh-huh.
And I know that there's a lot. I mean, you've gone into every aspect of their life. But what I was curious to know is what one or what few things did you take away from that you found to be, like, something that you thought was the most important of what they do in either diet or health or lifestyle?
All right. So Debbie is referring to a series that I'm currently writing on the Maasai on my blog on the WestonAPrice.org site, Mother Nature Obeyed. And it's a long series, and I only have the first two parts up. But the Maasai are a Kenyan and Tanzanian cattle herding tribe and in East Africa. And they were studied extensively by George Mann and Bruce Taylor and some other groups back in the 1960s and shown to have a very low rate of heart disease. And I think that, you know, there are a few different theories about why the Maasai had such a low rate of heart disease. One that was put forward by another author who had studied some rural Maasai and some modernized Maasai was that it was their social structure. So one theory was that because they don't have the stress that is involved in the sort of highly individualistic modern life, that this protects them against heart disease. I guess there's some merit to that. I think that the Maasai faced a lot of stress in, you know, am I going to be eaten by a lion today or not? And so I don't think their life was completely stress-free, but they certainly, you can imagine that their level of camaraderie and sharing and other aspects of their society might have been protective. Another theory was their cholesterol was so low, and in fact that was one of George Mann's theories. George Mann was a big opponent of the idea that dietary fat and animal fat caused heart disease, but he was quite fine with the idea that high cholesterol caused heart disease, and the Maasai in fact had a really low cholesterol. But I think it's really difficult to say that that's the most likely protective factor, because if you just compare the Maasai to the Katavans, for example, they eat very different diets and they have very different cholesterol levels, but they're both free of heart disease. The Katavans are a group on the Pacific Islands, and they eat a little bit of coconut, a little bit of fish, and a lot of starchy tubers and a little bit of fruit. And their diet's very different from the Maasai diet, and their cholesterol levels are a lot higher, and they still don't have heart disease. So I really think that the most protective factor is the nutrient density of their diet and the lack of refined junk foods. And And I, you know, there may be other factors, like maybe their environment is more pristine or something like that. Although even that is difficult to support because they had tons of exposure to smoke because they had huts where they would light their fires inside the hut and not have any windows. So, you know, one explorer reported that as soon as you would open the door of their hut, this massive cloud of smoke would come flying at you. And, you know, they had a lot of exposure to cow dung, and, you know, they had moderate hygienic practices, but not up to par with what we would consider hygienic in modern society. So they had a lot of exposure to things that theoretically should have been harmful, like pathogens and smoke and so on. So I don't think it's their pristine environment. I really think it's the lack of refined modern junk food and their traditional wisdom about, you know, what type of foods to eat in order to get adequate nutrition. You know, that modern nutrition may have been invented in the 20th century, and we know nutrition at the molecular level, but a lot of these groups were successful precisely because they had learned through trial and error over centuries about what types of foods that they should eat at different times in their life in order to get adequate nutrition to protect themselves. And I think that's probably what it really boils down to.
Okay. So again, it's that culprit of the refined foods, the white flour, white sugar, seed oils, that are the inflammatory agents, of course, not the animal, because they're eating all animal. The Catawbans aren't, but, yeah, that seems to be where you always end up. I think the social aspect is really important, too.
I agree with you that there's very good evidence that stress is a big factor in causing disease. It's just unclear to me exactly how to analyze how stressful the Maasai life was. You know, it was not stressful in certain ways that our life is, but it was more stressful in other ways. So maybe the balance was more in favor of what we could say were positive stressors. I really don't know the answer to that. It's just too hard to unravel. And, you know, Stefan Lindeberg reported that the Catawbans were had a lot of anxiety about sorcery. And in my reading, the Maasai have a lot of concern about sorcery, especially in the southern part of Maasai land. And maybe it's anxiety about sorcery is a positive stressor. I don't really know. But I really think it comes down to, you know, Price identified the displacing foods of modern commerce that were contributing to physical degeneration as white flour, white sugar, polished rice, canned goods, syrups, and vegetable oils. And I think that we can probably explain heart disease in the very same way. You know, a little bit of these things probably isn't going to be too harmful. You know, we see Asians who eat plenty of white rice and it doesn't provide a lot of nutrients, but they make up for that with a lot of other nutrient-dense foods. So I think there's a certain threshold where when you begin displacing so much of the diet with these displacing foods of modern commerce that don't have any nutrients in them and perhaps have other toxic factors in them, then what you wind up with is diseases of all kinds, whether it's tooth decay or heart disease.
Okay, Debbie, thank you for calling. We appreciate it. Chris Masterjohn, it is cholesterolandhealth.com. You've certainly, I guess, heard of what is it, Syndrome X or Metabolic Syndrome, this idea. It's really the carbs, the white flour and the pasta and the cookies and the cakes, the crackers and all of that. That's a big contributor to heart disease. What's your take on how carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, play into the role of actually clogging up the arteries? Keep it as simple as we can.
I am not an advocate of carbohydrate restriction per se. In other words, I don't think that carbohydrates themselves are the cause of disease. However, you know, Weston Price had an interesting quote where he advocated reducing the carbohydrate level to that found in to normal levels found in natural foods. And so, you know, if you think about that quote, really, when we're eating this refined junk, our carbohydrate level does increase. And that's because we're getting rid of all of the things that are good for you and leaving behind the carbohydrate. And I think the really bad thing about these foods is simply that they've been stripped of all of their protective factors.
Mm.
And when you eat a diet, you need some balance. You have energy. It's like what we were talking before about how oxidants can be produced by trying to process more energy than your cells are able to handle. Well, if you refine the carbohydrate, then you have to process that carbohydrate. But if you've gotten rid of all of the nutrients that help you process that energy molecule, then of course that's going to cause problems. So when you eat a diet that's rich in energy sources but poor in the nutrients that help you metabolize that energy, that generates oxidants and other harmful molecules that are going to damage the lipids in our blood and damage our blood vessels, and that's going to contribute to heart disease.
So are you saying the big difference between, say, organic brown rice or something like that in that area, whole grain, as opposed to a bun at Wendy's?
Yeah, exactly. I would add that brown rice is does have a lot of nutrients that white rice doesn't have. But a lot of people have digestive problems with brown rice. And if you look at a lot of the Asian and Indian cultures, they've been refining white rice for a lot longer time than people have been refining flour. And it probably hasn't been good for them. Robert McCarrison, around the time of a little before Weston Price, he had looked at all sorts of different diets in India, and he found that the ones that were heaviest in rice, which were invariably at least partially refined, that the poorest health was found in those communities. So it's probably, an older stressor. But I have no problem consuming brown rice if I boil it for an hour. But if I don't cook it so much, it gives me a lot of digestive problems. So,
interesting. Yeah. Some people have good luck with soaking these grains for a long time.
Right. The soaking can contribute to digestibility, and it can also make the nutrients more available.
Yeah.
So one of the things with modern refined carbohydrates is the mineral content is just miserable. And even in the whole grain products, I'm going to be posting an article on this on my website soon. Even like the whole wheat products, for example, since the green revolution, since industry really got into agriculture back in the 1960s, the wheat products that we have, even if they're whole wheat now, are very deficient in minerals compared to the whole wheat products of earlier in the century.
Sure.
But then we bastardize the wheat further in all sorts of ways by refining it and bleaching it with chlorine and bromate and doing all kinds of things to it. So,
yeah. So there's no telling. 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. If we eat more eggs, does that actually raise the blood cholesterol levels? And according to you and many other people, that main number cholesterol doesn't matter much anyway.
Right. So if there's been some research that's been done at our university here comparing the effects of eating 3 or 4 eggs a day to eggs that the yolks have been removed. So The yolks where all the cholesterol is. It's also where all lots of good nutrients are. And those studies have indicated that in most healthy people, the majority of healthy people, eggs have very little, if any, effect on the cholesterol at all. And that's because our bodies synthesize the vast majority of our cholesterol, so when we eat more of it, our bodies just make less of it. But there may be a little bit of less than a third of the population do experience rises in their total cholesterol, but it's fairly evenly distributed between LDL cholesterol and HDL cholesterol. And I don't necessarily agree with this, but the mainstream opinion is that LDL cholesterol is the so-called bad cholesterol,
right.
And HDL cholesterol is the so-called good cholesterol. So even by the mainstream standards, the eggs do not seem to be having a negative effect on blood lipids. And there's increasing interest in the size of the lipoprotein particles, where people now are believing that the large LDL particles, they call them large and fluffy ones, are protective, whereas the small and dense ones are the ones that are bad for you. And I don't really entirely agree with that either. But even from that perspective, the feeding more egg yolks is increasing the size of LDL particles in these people. So it seems to be having a positive effect. And they also can increase the concentration of certain antioxidants in the lipoprotein particles. So there's really, even from a mainstream perspective, there really isn't any good evidence that eating eggs causes harmful effects on your blood lipids. And then, you know, from my own perspective, then I would say even more so, I don't think there's any evidence of that, because I'm a bit skeptical of some of these measurements of blood lipids.
So if you went and had your blood test tomorrow and you had a cholesterol level of, say, 225 to 250, would you be concerned at all or do something to bring that down?
Well, I mean, first of all, 225 or 250 for total cholesterol is within the range of what the Katavans have, and there's no heart disease on that island. So I'm not convinced that 225 or 250 is outside of the range of what we would say is normal. Now, that doesn't mean that someone can't have bad stuff going on in their body.
Sure.
As an American, you know,
sure,
that cholesterol level. But, you know, one of the things that you really have to consider is, what was your cholesterol last time? Because if your cholesterol is 180, well, say this is your true cholesterol, the true average cholesterol for you as an individual on the same diet and lifestyle. The normal amount of variation without anything changing is for that to be able to go up or down about 35 milligrams per deciliter.
Hmm.
So if your cholesterol jumps from 180 to 210, say, you have no reason to think that it increased. You could go back the next time and see it gone down to 170. And, you know, that type of fluctuation is perfectly normal in some people. So you really have to have a large jump. Unless you really know, like if you test your cholesterol year after year and it's always 180, and then all of a sudden you have a big jump, then that might mean something.
What could that mean? Is, say, if you go from 180 for year after year and all of a sudden you're 280, what might that mean? Can you speculate?
If you're up to 280, you're really pushing that 300 range. There's two very likely explanations for it. They're not the only explanations, but they're two likely candidates. One is you have familial hypercholesterolemia, and the other is that you have hypothyroidism. And familial hypercholesterolemia is genetic, so it's quite unlikely that you would have 180 for your whole life and then all of a sudden you have 280. So I would, if I saw a large jump like that in cholesterol levels, I would get thyroid measures checked, because your thyroid hormone is one of the principal governors of your blood cholesterol, because it helps the cholesterol get to where it's going efficiently. So if your liver secretes a lipoprotein full of cholesterol, thyroid hormone will help it get to the cell, its destination tissue, faster, help it get into the cell. And so thyroid hormone's not reducing the amount of cholesterol in your body necessarily, and although it actually does do that by helping the cholesterol get converted into goodies like adrenal hormones and sex hormones.
Sure.
And bile acids and things.
And we've had,
but the main thing is it's just helping the cholesterol get to where it needs to go. So if thyroid all of a sudden is dysfunctioning, then the cholesterol is going to tend to accumulate in your blood.
Yeah. So then in closing, we'll leave it at that. But do you agree then with some of our past guests to say that getting the cholesterol down too low, 120, 130, 140, 150 range, can be dangerous because you can't make the hormones that you need? Do you agree with that?
It can be. It depends on why it's low. Again, we were talking about the Maasai, who eat tons of animal fat and don't have any heart disease, and their cholesterol is down that far. So just like I'm not convinced.
But we just don't know exactly why, huh?
Right. And we don't know exactly why. And so that's the thing. Whenever you see something that goes way outside the, you know, what is normal for you, then I think that could be a problem, whether it's gone really high or really low. But I think that, you know, we don't know why it went low or high. I mean, maybe it went high because we're making more cholesterol. Maybe that's not a problem. Maybe it went high because we have gone hypothyroid and we're not making hormones out of it anymore. That's bad. You know, maybe it went low because we're not making enough cholesterol and then we can't make our hormones. Maybe it went low because all of a sudden we started making our hormones really efficiently. And, you know, so we're using the cholesterol. So you can't know for sure. So I think when you see some large deviation from the norm, either the population norm or your own normal level, then you need to try to understand what is going on and run some further tests that might explain it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's ever, well, ever is a tough word, but just this idea of all the millions of people that are on these statin drugs to lower their cholesterol, it seems like perhaps other than the best idea in general?
It's probably not the best idea. I mean, it's possible that these drugs have a place somewhere, but they're being fed like candy. And, they don't just lower cholesterol, but they inhibit our synthesis of coenzyme Q10, which is important for energy metabolism and reduces the production of oxidants. That's one of the, that's not good for heart disease to get rid of that. And they may also decrease our conversion of the vitamin K found in plants to the active form of vitamin K2 that we need to protect our blood vessels from calcification. There's lots of indications of bad things that these statins can do, and that's been talked about in many places. I'm sure you've had other guests talking about it.
Sure.
I don't think it's good to be feeding these things like candy at all.
And, of course, as you know, many docs are still of the idea that this cholesterol number has to be down at a certain level.
Sure, and the worst part about that is that the docs will never run, hardly ever run further tests to try to understand why the cholesterol is out of the range. Like we were saying before, you know, if you say I have high cholesterol, I want to find out why. I want to find out if I have familial hypercholesterolemia or hypothyroidism. The doctor is likely to say, well, I'm not going to run that test because regardless, I'm just going to treat it with a statin, so why should I spend the money? That's probably the most harmful thing about this is by focusing on the concentration of cholesterol as the end point, we've lost sight of the fact that these numbers can change for a variety of reasons, and it might be important to find out what those reasons are.
Yeah. Well, it's been very interesting talking to you. Congratulations on your passion for this and the stuff I've read on the website's been quite interesting. And so I guess you put ongoing articles on brain and body wellness, brainandbodywellness.com. And so it'll be fun after you get your PhD in a couple months. Well, maybe you have you back on and we'll talk to a real doctor. I'm just kidding.
That's cholesterolandhealth.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say? Oh, I said brain.
That must be your next guest.
Already, I turned the page of my next guest. Sorry. Cholesterol. Oh, gosh. Just a talk show host not knowing what he's doing. I need more cholesterol. Cholesterolandhealth.com. So sorry. My apologies.
Thank you so much, Pat.
Chris Masterjohn. It's been fun talking to you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Great to talk to you, too. Thank you so much.
See you real soon. Okay. I was already onto the brain thing, man. Daniel Vitalis. Let's play a game. On a desert island, you can only pick one food. Just one. Just only one.
If I had to live off of one food, I think it would be, if I had any choice, it'd probably be colostrum. It's the most complete food that I know of. And the thing about colostrum is it's the first food for any mammal. So it's kind of a no-brainer that colostrum contains all essential fats, it contains all essential amino acids, it contains all essential glyconutrients, which are carbohydrates. It basically contains every substance that we need to maintain our bodies. The first milking you get from a cow after the cow calves is called colostrum. Every milking thereafter is called transitional milk. And what it is it's part colostrum and part milk. So that's something that can happen in the industry because people will sell you the transitional milk and call it colostrum. We're very careful not to do that. We only use the first milking of the animals.
Pure colostrum from Sirthrival. They take the moisture out. That's it. To order, click on the picture of colostrum front page, oneradionetwork.com. I'm with Al Carter, the world's foremost authority on rebound exercise. Al, you patented it, designed the rebound air. How can you possibly give a lifetime warranty on a piece of equipment?
Because we designed it to be used by the United States Air Force and showed us how we could make sure that the equipment would last a very, very long time.
So if a spring breaks or if a mat would rip or something with a leg, you replace it?
Yes, call us up and we'll replace it right away.
Lifetime.
Lifetime.
Order yourself a rebounder right now. Front page, look at the display for the rebounders on oneradionetwork.com. Go through PayPal, very secure. Don't have to be a PayPal member. Any credit card, ship it via UPS in 3 days or so. It's all yours. Right on the front page of oneradionetwork.com. Yeah, baby, these are really fun little things. They're about 4 feet in diameter. And, oh, I'd say about 10 or 12 inches tall, and you can put them behind a bed when you're not using them or out in the porch, just so they're covered up. And they're really well built with a lifetime warranty, so this is a pretty amazing tool. Consider getting yourself one of these guys. It's one of the most fun things that I've had in my health regimen for about 15 years now, and just really quite remarkable. You can do the health bounce on there where you don't just... jump around a little bit, and you don't even leave the mat, or you can just really jump up and down and really build muscles and all of that. These are these rebounders. We love them. And right on the front page of oneradionetwork.com.
From the Hill Country in Texas, this is oneradionetwork.com.
Round number two. Good morning. Running a couple minutes late, but what the heck? It is October 11, 2011. Our phone lines are always open. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. And we're now broadcasting live every morning on naturalnewsradio.com. Pleasure to do that. We're going to move from the heart to the head. Whoa. Quick little jaunt. Up to Dallas, Texas, talk with a gentleman who we've had the pleasure to talk with. Oh, it's been about 3 years now, a long time. Dr. Ross Stewart. He's been a behavioral psychologist for over 40 years. He has a practice up in Dallas for over 30 years, and he looks at some of the personality issues and also the physical disorders and the connection, and it's really focusing in on now on cognitive decline, things like Alzheimer's and dementia. Depression, ADHD, Parkinson, neurotransmitters in the brain. His website, brainandbodywellnesscenter.com. Dr. Stewart, good morning.
Patrick, it's a pleasure to be with you again this morning. It has been too long. I think it's been 3 years.
It has been a very, very long time. How's your brain?
You know, my brain is operating quite well. I know a few secrets about how to keep it running well.
Really, really. You've been... doing the amino acid work for a long time, haven't you?
Almost 11 years, Patrick.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we've had startlingly good results with it for the vast majority of people.
So when you look at a patient and you get their amino acid levels, Dr. Stewart, and you give amino acid therapy, is that too simplistic? Is that generally what you do?
Generally what I do, but as goes human beings, Patrick, it's a little more complicated than that.
Well, tell us a little bit about it, how it works.
Okay. The entire brain and central nervous system is run on something called neurotransmitters. If you look at your brain and central nervous system as the information superhighway of your body, sending and receiving messages, it is necessary for all these things to operate correctly if you have sufficient levels of neurotransmitters. That's what carries the message from one nerve cell to the next. And we have some bad news. At age 40, our body's ability to produce these neurotransmitters starts to decline. And that means that the brain and central nervous system don't operate as well. So every organ system in your body, from your stomach to your heart to your liver to your thyroid to your adrenal glands to all the parts of your brain that regulate you, start into a slow decline. How's that for bad news, Patrick?
Well, why would that be? I mean, gosh, we can live for a very, very long time in nature. Why would the neurotransmitters start to go down at 40 or 50 or in that range?
You know, in the history of humanity, after you leave childbearing age, nature is not so much your friend anymore. You've already done your job. You've produced offspring. And genetically, we all start to decline. That's what the aging process is about. And if you'll recall, those 3 years ago, and I'm sure you remember this in detail, Patrick.
Yeah.
genetically, we start to unwind. And so we get more frail and more frail with each passing year. Ah, but there's some good things to do about it. We also have something else that really contributes to the puzzle here. The stomach juices, that's hydrochloric acid and betaine and so on, they also start to decline in production about age 40. And so not only do we have fewer neurotransmitters, but our digestion starts to become impaired, and we, in some small way, start to starve to death. Now, I know you've heard that one before.
Yeah, there's a lot of that that goes around for people on a standard American diet. I think it can be argued that this 40 age moves up a great deal for people on a really good diet, but that may be another subject for another day.
Well, you know, we have to address it somewhere in here. Because if you're not going to have a lot of high-quality protein, you're not going to be able to build neurotransmitters. Because that's what the building blocks are. They're amino acids that we get from proteins in our diet.
Where do the vegetarians get it, Doc?
Oh, being a vegetarian is a very tough life. You know, beans have some in, grains have some in, and there are a number of things like whey protein from hemp and peas and so on. And you're going to have to supplement your diet if you're really going to get the essential amino acids that you need to sustain your life.
So these amino acids make all of the neurotransmitters. And tell us some of the neurotransmitters. Would we know the names of these, some of these guys?
Oh, well, there's 193 of them.
193? Do you know all of them? How's your brain?
Well, Patrick, I was going to quiz you on that.
Okay.
You know, for example, we have one neurotransmitter that tells our diaphragm to move. But there are four central ones that are critical for any area of cognitive decline and optimum brain function. They are serotonin, which many people have heard about.
Sure.
Dopamine.
Sure.
Anyone with Parkinson's disease has certainly heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
Norepinephrine and epinephrine. And maybe I could give you a quick definition of each of these.
Yeah.
And then we can start talking about how to understand the issues of cognitive decline and actually what to do about it. Serotonin is the master regulator of all 193 known ones. It has to do with depression and sadness. And here's how that works. If you have enough serotonin, you are biologically supported in feeling neutral. You are not biologically supported in feeling sad or depressed. And that's a really important consideration. Serotonin also heavily impacts sleep because it becomes melatonin. That's what puts you to sleep and keeps you asleep. It also regulates appetite. So you see any number of people who have weight issues, oh, and what goes with it? Very frequently a sleep disorder, sleep apnea, for example, and depression.
Oh, if the serotonin levels are low, Doc?
Yeah.
I don't want to get off track here too much, but just in general, so we can follow the bouncing ball here this morning, with the serotonin level, would you start working back to nutritional deficiencies? Would that be the number one cause of why the serotonin levels get down?
You got it right on the money, Patrick. That's exactly where to go, nutritionally. and digestion-wise.
Uh-huh. So if you're not digesting, you don't have the HCL, you don't have the stomach juices, you're not really working it, then you don't, you can't get the serotonin out of the proteins, out of the, and make the amino acids?
Yes. And here's how, I don't want to get too far off track either, but I think this is important to understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you take in proteins and you don't digest them, what happens to that meat and protein? It becomes the equivalent of roadkill.
Roadkill, huh.
Well, it putrefies in your digestive tract. And then those toxins manage to get into your blood system, and we have all sorts of autoimmune disorders as a direct result. Digestion is critical. Oh, and by the way, Patrick, 95% of serotonin is used in the nerve ganglion in the digestive tract. So you start getting the idea, this serotonin stuff is really important.
Is that one of the first things to go when the digestion is not up to snuff?
That's exactly right.
Really? Boy, that's not good.
That's exactly right.
Could that be a reason then there's so many sleep disorders in this country?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that, but this is, I would check this one as number one.
So we're going to get on to some of the other ones, the dopamine and the neuro, those other ones, which I can't pronounce. So how do you test for these with saliva testing?
No, you really can't do it with that.
Oh, you don't?
Here's the reason. Let's say you wanted to check for serotonin and the other neurotransmitters via the blood.
Mm-hmm.
What you get is a snapshot of exactly what's in the blood at that second.
All right.
Oh, and by the way, if a person sees the needle coming, their norepinephrine and epinephrine start to spike out of fear.
Oh, great.
So now we get a really warped view of it. And if we do it with saliva, saliva is too immediate also. So we do it with urine. And we do it about 4:30 in the afternoon because neurotransmitters, just like sleep, go through a circadian rhythm.
What about the different saliva programs, Doc, that do it about 4 or 5 times during the day?
Check well, that's with, cortisol.
Oh, that's all for cortisol?
Yeah. That cortisol test is really a helpful test.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of outside of what we're talking about today.
Okay.
But you want to get a really accurate view of how good your adrenal glands are working, and you want an explanation as to how come you don't sleep well at night or how come you're tired late in the afternoon, that adrenal stress test is really a wonderful tool. And it also tells us exactly how to nutritionally intervene. Your adrenal glands is one of the few systems in your body that is capable of a robust recovery, which means you can have youthful functioning in your adrenal glands again. And that's through nutrition, and it's through lifestyle changes. Get your stress low.
So is that one of the big guys for adrenal fatigue, which is epidemic, I hear, in our country, is just our reaction to the stresses of life on planet Earth in 2011?
Well, let me give you, that's my point of view completely. Let me give you a data point. In 2011, the average first grader experiences the same amount of stress that the average 21-year-old experienced in 1950.
Where'd you get that?
I don't know exactly where I got it, but I keep up on a number of these things, and you know, to find the reference point anymore is just impossible.
Sure, it's been some time. So when you say, and how are you defining stress in that term, Dr. Stewart?
Let me give you an example, because I used to do school consultations when I started my career in 1970, and I recently, in December, did another school consultation. We'll actually do another one this week. So I get to see what first graders are exposed to from 1970 compared to 2011.
Hmm.
I'm here to tell you, the stress on the teachers, the stress on the kids, this is really a bad scene.
Stress meaning just from outside pressure, peer pressure, blah, blah, television, everything is what you're talking about?
I'm talking about just alone what goes on in the schools.
In the schools themselves.
They're trying to push academic learning lower and lower in terms of age, to the point that half the kids are absolutely brain-wise incapable of learning what's being pushed. And I talk to the teachers about it, and they say, we don't have a choice.
So this kind of stress on the little ones, just trying to move them along too fast, is very stressful on the body.
Yes. Hmm. How come education thinks they have to push kids so hard when the real point of education is make learning fun so you become a lifelong learner?
Yeah.
You know, and that really takes us to dopamine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that manages pleasure and happiness. This is the one that puts a smile on your face. This is the one that allows you to use the motor cortex of your brain to walk and talk and do all the things we do. Matter of fact, when we get people to high levels of dopamine, their athletic performance improves. We also see that rational and logical thinking dramatically improves. When we get these things right in kids, we see math and science become their friend, not their enemy. That's really important stuff.
So, in general, overall, in a perfect world, if somebody handles stress well and they eat really, say if they figured out their good ancestral diet, Dr. Stewart, and they really get that nailed over with trial and success, these levels should be okay.
Well, we're not sure of that anymore.
Because of all the different variables, you mean?
No. You know, there was a big study in the 30s called the Pottinger's Cat Study.
Right, yeah.
And I know you know about that because we talked about it many years ago. And what we're seeing is that there's a genetic degradation in human beings based on poor diet.
Mm.
And so, you know, when you take a look at 1970 versus 2010 and you say the incidence of depression is up 370%, the incidence of ADHD is up 400%, that's not an accident. Now, the thing is, it's so hard to know what all the contributing factors is. And, you know, when we look at our seniors today, that is anyone over age 60, we're looking at how come one in eight of those people who are 65 has some form of Alzheimer's. How come we look at people who are in their 80s and we see 9 out of 10 have some significant portion of cognitive decline? That doesn't have to be that way. You know, when we look at serotonin, we know that there are 7 areas of the brain that absolutely require serotonin to function correctly. One of them is our prefrontal cortex. That's the forehead part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you say, well, what does that do? Well, it gives us such things as empathy, cause and effect, consequences, time function. We actually know if we drink a lot of alcohol tonight, we're going to have a hangover tomorrow. So if I don't do my homework now, the teacher's going to yell at me. And if that part of the brain, which is serotonin-driven, doesn't work correctly, we see a lot of poor judgment. And do we see people as they age, do they get more and more poor judgment? Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way, Patrick.
Hmm.
It just doesn't.
We've had a gentleman on the show not long ago, Dr. Stewart, that suggests that many of the pharmaceutical drugs and the over-drugging of our culture are destroying that prefrontal lobe cortex thing.
Well, I agree with whoever that man was.
I think it was Goodman, I believe. Goodman, yeah. You agree with that?
I don't know him, but I like him.
Okay.
Here's what we're looking at. You know, Johns Hopkins University in 2010 did a massive study on the effects of all the antidepressants. And what they found is that of every 100 people who take antidepressants, 93 of them experience brain damage.
Wow.
And so depression, which many of our seniors experience, and they don't have to. If we get serotonin and dopamine right, they don't have to experience depression at all. Here's the point. After age 60, when you don't have enough levels of serotonin and dopamine, these medications absolutely don't help. I mean, I'm just not making that up. This is what the definitive research is telling us. And so the only hope they really have is to be taking in those proteins that allow their brain to produce serotonin and dopamine, so they step out of the depression.
Mm-hmm.
One more critical factor with this is that depression used to come and go. You might be depressed for a few weeks, then you get over it and you feel well again. Once the introduction of things like Prozac and Wellbutrin, Effexor, and so on came on, people stopped cycling. They stayed in the depression permanently. So if the man's name is Goodman, he's a good man. He told exactly what medical science is telling us.
Yeah.
Antidepressants are not our friend, but getting your diet right, that is our friend.
25 minutes after the hour with Dr. Ross Stewart, his website, I can say that, brainandbodywellnesscenter.com. He's in Dallas, been a behavioral psychologist for about 41 years, private practice in Dallas, 30-plus years, and brainandbodywellnesscenter.com. 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So I'm curious, if someone from a spiritual, mental, emotional level has issues with this or that and they worry and they get depressed and all of this, I suspect then that will affect the levels of their serotonin and dopamine. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, it's more than a fair statement, Patrick.
Okay. So then, Doc, if you would go in there and give them extra serotonin or dopamine, say with amino acid therapy or something, isn't that going to be a problem? Because they're going to still keep doing the same thing they're going to be doing, but they'll be feeling better while they're doing it?
Well, the answer is yes, and chances are that their brain is going to be functioning at a much higher level, and their spiritual practices are going to go to a new level.
Uh-huh. It'll give them the space, maybe, to change their behavior.
Give them the space to change their behavior.
Hmm.
Also, if you experience depression, every day is a dark, cloudy day, no matter what the sun is doing. If we get serotonin and dopamine right, every day starts to become a sunny day, whether it's gray or sunny outside. And if you look at, if your perspective is, it's a bright, sunny day, your thoughts are going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Physiology is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Your heart function will change. Your adrenal function will change. Your digestion will change. So this thing about getting the serotonin and dopamine right, wow. You know, with cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, dementia, what we're finding is that this is a very hard diagnosis for the clinician to make in the office. And for 34% of those people, it's actually a serotonin issue. It is not the tangles and plaquing of Alzheimer's. It's just it's so hard to diagnose.
Really?
We've had people who appeared to be in late-stage Alzheimer's and very sadly look like they're dumb as a stone. They can't remember their children. They can't remember they can't remember what they had for breakfast. They don't know who's the president. I mean, a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
6 weeks later when we got them optimized, they were completely restored.
Optimized meaning using the amino acid?
Yes, we got them into the sweet spot, and they were restored. Oh, and they were depressed before, and they're not at all depressed now.
And you can tell the way to balance this amino acid therapy simply through this urine test?
Oh, we do it in a couple of ways. One, we're always going to set up a success criteria. There are five or six symptoms that people have that they hate that are ruining the quality of their life.
That's right. And they probably know those, boy, real quick, don't they?
Oh, I'll say, hey, tell me the five symptoms. Well, blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, they got them.
Right there.
They got them.
They're not, those symptoms are not strangers. And so we want to do it. The reason anyone comes to a doctor is because they want symptom relief. I haven't had anyone come and say, you know, I feel great, and I want to continue to feel great. What can you do? People don't come for that reason. They come because they want symptom relief. And we use the urine tests to guide us into the correct dosage. Because, you know, it's just like shoes where everyone doesn't wear the same size. Everyone doesn't need the same amount of amino acids to regulate their brain and central nervous system. But, you know, when you can take a field like senior citizens, and for those people who are starting to experience their number one fear, memory loss. Isn't that amazing, Patrick? They're more afraid of memory loss than cancer or heart disease.
Is that right?
It is true. When you can offer 34% help in restoring cognitive function, they consider this absolutely a blessing. And, you know, the number one problem with our seniors is they're depressed. And our numbers are about 85% of those can be primarily restored to happiness. Nothing else offers that we know of. These are terrifically useful. This is terrifically useful information for people who have a loved one and they're seeing him decline, or they're starting to show the first signs of it themselves.
It's exactly 10:30. Dr. Stewart, can you stay right there a second? We'll do.
Absolutely, be delighted.
Okay,
to.
Dr. Ross Stewart. Very interesting, isn't it? Brain and Body Wellness Center.com. Dr. Ross Stewart, do you have a question? We have many of you listening this morning, and our phone lines are always open. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@1radionetwork.com. Tomorrow is our regular Wednesday session with Andrew Goss. Quite a few of you have taken Mr. Goss to task over his comments about the Occupy Wall Street. We're getting some emails in about that, so we're going to address that tomorrow. And also tomorrow, after that, there's some people out in California and in Washington, D.C. are trying to get genetically modified foods labeled. We'll speak to them. Then on Thursday, a couple of folks, we're going to talk with a natural OBGYN about birth control, about baby things and hormones and stuff and ladies' issues. And then also the perfect health diet. On Thursday, I could use one of those. Open phone Friday. So we got a lot of cool things coming up on OneRadioNetwork.com. Regardless of what kind of diet you have, and everybody has their own special one, we're all trying to figure out just the right thing to eat. And for me, your host here, it's a moving target. Boy, I change momentarily, but just try to figure it out. I think that adding a green juice, you're talking about greens, spinach or parsley, cucumbers, celery, carrots, beets, those kinds of things, into your diet every day, I think any of us can do well to add that. This new juicer that we have is pretty cool. It's the J. Cordage Power Juicer, the Power Grind Juicer. And it's available on OneRadioNetwork.com under $300. And this way will last you a very, very long time. Where do you see how well-engineered it is? It's quite heavy. Because of its heaviness and its sturdiness, it can move at a low RPM, which really can extract the great amount of juice out of vegetables at a low RPM. So it really helps the oxidation. I love the way it all fits together. I find it very easy to clean. You just pull out a few pieces with the hose. I got a little sprayer attachment on the hose, or you can just have a faucet and hot water. I don't wash mine. It just seems fine to me. This is cool. You can also do nut milks. This is a nice juicer. Click on the front page or on the store on OneRadioNetwork.com, and we'll receive a commission, and that's how we support our efforts here. It's the J. Cordage Power Grind Juicer. It's a beauty. OneRadioNetwork.com. I'm with Al Carter. He's the world's foremost authority of rebound exercise. Al, one of my favorite things about rebounding for the last 15 years is I do it. I mean, it's not like something I think about. I do it because it's right there, right on my porch, and I just do it.
That's right.
Yeah, isn't that a wonderful thing? And I heard you say that you can do it whenever you're in the mood, not in the mood, or in the nude.
Yes, and anytime you want to rebound, if it's in your own private home, you can exercise anytime you want to, recognizing you're going to build balance, coordination, rhythm, timing, dexterity, and kinesthetic awareness while building muscle bulk and strength.
How about the ladies listening and building up, like firming the bust line and firming the old buttocks? Does it work for that?
Yes. It will help all those things. But one of the other things it'll do is it'll stimulate or strengthen the sphincter muscles.
Really
those ladies
important.
Who know what a sphincter muscle is knows what we're talking about.
Really important. Order yourself a rebounder right now. Front page, look at the display for the rebounders on OneRadioNetwork.com. Go through PayPal, very secure. Don't have to be a PayPal member. Any credit card, ship it via UPS in 3 days or so. It's all yours right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
Know the source on One Radio Network.
Talk to Patrick now, 888-663-6386, or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
Talking about the good old brain with Dr. Ross Stewart, Brain and Body Wellness Center.com. He's in the Dallas area. Amelia wants to know if you take patients long distance.
Absolutely, I do, Patrick.
You do?
She will call. As a matter of fact, 30% of our clientele is worldwide.
Really?
And if she'll call and reference your name, Patrick, she'll have a free consultation with one, me or one of our staff. You can give her my phone number, 972-248-0780.
Is that 972-248-0780? Mm-hmm. So I guess you would just, you walk folks through of doing this urine analysis, you send them the stuff, and you start there?
That's exactly right. And, you know, we really hold people's hands with this. The way we've run our practice is it's a very personal practice, and people say how cared about they are. This is a tough thing to go through, and you really want someone who's had, I've seen 29,000 people in my career. I've regulated thousands of people's brain chemistry, and we really know how to hold a person's hand while they get this right. By the way, you might recommend to her, she get a rebounder. Those things are fabulous for circulation and for the brain.
It's good to get, yeah, good to get that circulation up there, isn't it?
Oh, it is just, oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stewart, I was introduced to an amino acid product. I bet you know these people. They're up by you. Is it Dew's 21st Century Products? Do you know them?
Absolutely, I do.
Yeah, they have an amino acid product that Dr. Stephen Hines recommended that I get, and I got some, and seems pretty interesting. It's got all these different amino acids. Do you like that product?
I like it for people who don't have a therapeutic issue.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful support product, and we find that people need a particular blend that's unique to them.
Huh.
We're going to go after 5-hydroxytryptophan, 5-HTP, we're going to go after lysine, we're going to go after tyrosine, we're going to go after L-DOPA, and it has to be a very particular dosage for each person.
I see. Why wouldn't the body be able to get all of them like you're getting something like that and just kind of pick out what it needs?
A couple of reasons. One, we already surfaced, is their digestion is hurt. The second is, and you can answer this one, it probably as well or better than I can, Patrick, what's happened to the food source? If you've got 7 chickens in a cage that's designed for no chickens, and they eat corn all the time, how much serotonin are you going to get, builders, are you going to get out of the meat?
Uh-huh.
Very little.
Uh-huh.
What happens to cattle when before they butchered? They go to a feedlot where they're fed grains, and the tryptophan is stripped out of their flesh by the corn and the other grains. So, you know, and as you listen to your program, you've had a number of people on who say, hey, nutritionally, we're bordering on bankruptcy. And so by the time they come to see us, they already have clinical issues. And for the vast majority of the people who come, simply changing their diet is not going to be enough.
Mm-hmm. They need to use this as medicine, these amino acids.
They have to use it as in a therapeutic dosage for their unique chemistry.
Mm-hmm. And then some of these products, if you want to take amino acids, and that just helps support as you go along, is what you're saying?
Well, you know, in our medical database, we have 2.2 million days of patient observation. And we've really come to the point of, we want to pinpoint the exact amount that somebody needs of these things and give them that amount. We know that if they're going to take 21st century products, in addition to ours, that it's going to be very hard for us to regulate it. You actually can't eat much of it.
Oh, really? Well, but then if you're taking your, say, if you get on your program to get your little brain not so wonky, but aren't they going to get amino acids with just a regular diet anyway? I mean, so I don't understand what you just said.
I'll thank you for telling me that, Patrick.
Okay.
You know, from us, you're going to get several capsules. And this is half joke, half truth. You don't have to take these capsules from us. You can eat 17 raw egg yolks and get the amount that you need.
Okay.
Or 33 ounces of raw grass-fed hamburger.
Oh.
Okay, well, we haven't had anybody who said that's a good idea.
Probably not.
Patrick, have you ever eaten a raw egg yolk?
Oh, yeah, I like them, actually.
I do, too. I put salt and pepper on them and eat one a week.
Yeah, they're good.
I would not eat 17 of those every day. So we're talking about really high doses of this to overcome the issues that people have. And we find that based on this massive amount of research we have, that people need a specific amount of these targeted proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to get, their diet is not going to alter very much what's going on. But if they start taking a lot of 21st century Makuna, which is an L-DOPA supplement, they're going to get an imbalance, and it's going to start to impact the amount of serotonin that they produce, because L-DOPA is dopamine.
I see, yeah.
They're not trying to make it too complicated.
Yeah.
We have enzyme factories inside of us that take amino acids and build the proteins that we are. We're a big bundle of proteins inside our skin. The factory that produces dopamine is the same factory that produces serotonin at the same time. So if you load it up with dopamine builders, what's it going to produce? Dopamine, to the detriment of the serotonin that you desperately need. Patrick, did that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. I'm just wondering, I'd like to understand, though, that when people are having the depression or sleeplessness and all the different things that you deal with, Alzheimer's, and you know that they have an imbalance in their dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, and the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a nutritional deficiency, or is it something that's been kind of hardwired? In other words, with the amino acids, can you build it up so then you won't take them someday?
Oh, I wish that was true. There's two things going on. One, for all those people who have taken drugs and sometimes, you know, the thimerosal in inoculations and so on.
Right.
They've actually experienced something called neural bundle damage.
They've actually got neurotransmitter damage.
You got it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that's one of the reasons we see this, that so many kids have ADHD, and for the first time in history, wildly high numbers of childhood depression.
Huh.
This is a new phenomenon, Patrick.
Hmm.
In any event, we pin a lot of it back to these inoculations, and I know you've had guests on your program that have talked about this in the past.
Hmm.
So we know that this is not a fiction. The research is overabundant. And if it is indeed neural bundle damage, they're going to have to stay on some extraordinarily high level of amino acids to overcome the damage. And that medical science now has offered this to us. We can now do it.
So then there would be a chance, I guess, depending on how positive one looks at this or your philosophical, that you could then rebuild that, perhaps. Rebuild those.
Possible. It depends on what's underneath it, you know?
Yeah.
It depends on what the cause is. If the cause is neural bundle damage, we're not going to overcome it. Patrick, have you ever heard a thing about what's the cause of bipolar disorder, which is now a very popular diagnosis?
No, I have no idea what would cause that other than standard American diet and our standard American lifestyle.
Okay, well, here's the explanation coming out of Johns Hopkins University. Bipolar disorder was all but unheard of until the introduction of antidepressant drugs. The antidepressant drugs damaged the brain and central nervous system to the point that people no longer cycled in and out of depression. They stayed in it full time. And so the only way that they knew to cope with it was to give them more Wellbutrin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
These things damage the brain significantly and the entire endocrine system. And so people have medically induced bipolar disorder. This is really a mess to deal with. And if you have a loved one who has it, oh, it's just a nightmare.
What are the symptoms of that?
There are two major symptoms. And it has to do with cycling between deep depression and euphoria.
Hmm.
The euphoria makes people truly unrealistic. They'll get intoxicated on their own brain chemistry and say, I'm now Superman or Superwoman. I can do the impossible. Well, just because they think they can do it doesn't mean they can do it. You know, this is kind of the same sadness that you see with someone with Parkinson's disease, which is also really hard to regulate. And it's also a growing epidemic. And the challenge is, as people have prescription L-DOPA, mm-hmm. of course, increased dopamine, one of the issues is, remember serotonin? Serotonin levels decline, and the person's going to get what diagnosis, Patrick? Depression.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we see so many Parkinson's people who have a partial remission of the tremors or the unsteadiness or the stiffness, and they're depressed. They're terribly depressed because those enzyme factories that produce serotonin and dopamine are being almost exclusively used to produce dopamine. And serotonin is the one that controls whether we're depressed or not.
Randall in Oregon wants to know, what are some things right now that we can do dietary to support proper serotonin, etc., and also your tips on improving digestion?
Okay, let's go with digestion right away.
Okay.
There are two things. If you very carefully add a hydrochloric acid supplement or a betaine hydrochloric acid supplement,
mm-hmm.
and avoid the purple pill, avoid Tums,
mm-hmm.
what you're going to do is you're going to increase the amount of hydrochloric acid and betaine. That means that proteins are going to be digested immediately a lot better. And what you do is you take one or two of those at the end of each meal. The second thing is, want you to increase the amount of turkey that you eat. The more natural, the better. Grass-fed beef is real high in 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan, and tyrosine. And the point is, eat somewhere around 10 to 12 ounces of those things every day. Organic eggs are another really good source of these essential amino acids. And I can't emphasize enough, chew your food.
Chew your food. If you right. if you take a go ahead.
No.
Okay. If you take a couple betaine hydrochloric acid stock after your meal,
right.
or two or three or even four, and you don't feel any kind of discomfort or burning, is that an indication that you were low on hydrochloric acid?
It probably is.
Is it?
You've talked to somebody who understands digestion, Patrick.
Yeah, we have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so many people have heartburn, and it's because they have insufficient hydrochloric acid, as your previous guest has told you.
Right.
So we've had any number of people who we've put on a betaine hydrochloride. The very first meal, their digestion improves, and they stop taking the antacids.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of several weeks, any number of joint pains start to disappear.
Why? What do you attribute that to, Dr. Stewart?
Remember roadkill?
Oh, yeah, the putrefaction thing.
So if putrefaction isn't happening, though those toxins that are actually damaging your joints aren't there anymore, and your joints have an opportunity to repair, and the pain goes away.
So then you got the whole autoimmune things, Doc, and those and leaky gut and God knows what with all that.
That's exactly right, Patrick. Hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Looking to do away with those things.
Yeah. So I guess you covered it. So obviously you're a proponent of a animal-based diet for these amino acids and the healthy brain. How do you then justify, or how can it be that vegetarians, I mean, I've talked to some vegetarians that are very, got great brains and think clearly, and how do they do it without these animal foods?
Well, you know, if it's a really conscientious, well-educated effort, you can get the essential amino acids and proteins that you need from vegetables and some grains. So here's the rule of thumb, Patrick. The typical vegetarian who comes to see me says, well, I'm going to do it for health reasons. And then we do a symptom survey on them, and what we find is that they're doing it poorly, and they're less healthy than other people.
Oh, they're doing the vegetarian poorly.
They're doing the vegetarian poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about our program is all of our amino acids come from beans.
From beans.
So our program is completely vegetarian.
That's interesting. You're such an advocate of grass-fed animal food, but then you're using the beans as the medicine.
Well, it's really the only cost-effective way to get really high-quality proteins. You know, if they're synthesized in a laboratory, we're not going to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
But they come from beans, and the amino acid is in real high integrity. And it's pre-digested so that people get the full benefit of it.
An emailer, Leslie, she wants to know, how long generally before people feel results on your program?
Between 1 and 5 weeks.
As soon as 1 week?
Yes, the very last person we had, started feeling it in 3 days. Now, with Parkinson's, it's another issue because Parkinson's is such a tough situation to deal with significant brain deterioration. That actually takes a lot longer. But for cognitive decline and for vascular dementia and for misdiagnosed Alzheimer's, boy, 5 weeks, people are starting to see great results. Within 2 months, we have them regulated, and if they're going to come back, they're back.
So misdiagnosed Alzheimer's, what's your definition of that, Dr. Stewart?
In the realm of cognitive decline, which involves dementia and Alzheimer's, it's a clinical judgment usually, which means you do it based on symptoms. And does every practitioner look at the same set of symptoms? No. And do some of these have the same symptoms, whether it's cognitive decline, dementia, or Alzheimer's? They share similar symptoms. And if it isn't the plaquing and the tangles of Alzheimer's, chances are it is a serotonin deficiency, and 7 major parts of the brain start to decline, including memory and judgment. So it's almost impossible to tell what someone has until we've done an amino acid program with them, and then we know if it's in the serotonin system or not. That's why we're effective with 34%, because it is serotonin. The other 66%, we can help them with depression, but we're not going to overcome the cognitive decline symptoms.
You mean because there's hard wiring, neural bundle damage with some Parkinson's, and you haven't figured out a way how to fix that?
Yeah. It's in a portion of the brain called the substantia nigra, and it creates dopamine, and there's dopamine receptors in the motor cortex, which is very close by. And something causes those things to go senescent. That means they go inactive.
Mm.
Doesn't mean they're dead. It means they go inactive. And what we're able to do by increasing the amount of serotonin and dopamine builders is help those portions of the brain get active again.
Mm. What about people listening who have moms and dads and grandma and grandpa that say, man, this might be something interesting to get grandma involved in, or dad or mom, and they're on a lot of pharmaceuticals. I mean, would it still work?
Well, here's the thing with pharmaceuticals. They have there's no evidence that any of the pharmaceuticals are working.
Right.
And as I checked the research as to where it's headed, it seems to me they're headed the wrong direction.
They keep giving more, huh, Doc?
And they keep giving more, and they're giving things that, that are conceptually, theoretically wrong. The thing is, if you go to our website and look at the massive amount of quality information we have there, it's a real education as to what's possible for you and for other seniors, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, you know, give us a call. I mean, we are really friendly. And you call, us at 972-248-0780. We're glad to give you information. There's no obligation for anything else other than we're happy to talk to you.
Oh, that's nice of you. And you have someone other than yourself up there that works with patients?
There's six of us.
Six of you. I'll be done. And if folks mention One Radio Network, you'll give them a free consultation just right off the bat, and then you'll be easy on them if they're crazy, right? You'll say, "Oh, I have to tell you, you know, you're just a little bit crazy, but since you're a friend of Patrick's, we'll be."
That's the story, Patrick. If they're a friend of yours, they're a friend of ours.
Oh yeah. So I'm still a little bit unclear. So if there is some bundle damage with the nerves and such,
yeah,
and you're able to help people, Dr. Stewart, with amino acids,
right,
in the right doses, are the amino acids taken regularly? Are they the ones that kind of taking the place of the brain that's maybe damaged?
You got it, Patrick. You have to take them 2 to 3 times a day. You know, there's no easy way to get from a damaged brain to full function.
Yeah.
Work. And the majority of the work is in the sustaining of it, because you have to keep taking this stuff. But you know, if you're going to be either terribly depressed or you're going to lose your memory, it seems many people think it's a small price to pay to take these supplements every day.
Well, many of the moms and dads of our listeners, or the grandma, you know, they're taking a lot of stuff anyway. I mean, you get kind of used to taking a lot of stuff. Have you ever, kind of a strange question, but have you ever taken, say, someone 65, 70, 75, or in that range, or whatever age,
yeah,
off of all their stuff and just done the, you know, all the different meds that they're on and just done the amino acid?
Let me tell you a story about it, because the answer is yes.
Have you?
I had a woman come in who was on 27 prescription medications.
27?
And she was depressed to the point that all she could do was cry all day.
Oh, how old is she?
67.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at this and I said, this is insane. And so we worked with her physician and we took her off 24 of them and put her on our amino acid program.
You got rid of 24 out of 27?
Right. She had to stay on 3 of them because she had had such a bad autoimmune situation that the joints in her fingers had dissolved and she had free-floating digits that hurt.
My goodness.
And that's a whole other story.
Sure.
But she said this joke. She said, "Dr. Ross, I'm not Catholic, but I'm going to nominate you for sainthood." And I said, that is really a precious thing to say, you know?
So what happened? You took off her 24 out of the 27. You put her on amino acids and...
Her depression was gone.
Really?
Her mood increased. Her digestion was better. Remember, serotonin is 95% used in the guts. And it just went on and on and on. We recently had a person who... she was a public school teacher in a major city in the Northeast. You can imagine the war zone she was in.
Okay, we only have 60 seconds, so...
She went to a Caribbean island in retirement, immediately fell into cognitive decline, and was in despair. Her family contacted me, and 5 weeks later, she was completely restored.
With amino acids, now.
With amino acids.
What about, and I am real short on time, but just in general, what about all these different things that these 24 drugs, going back to the first lady, that they were supposed to be helping her body? I mean, it didn't affect her body negatively to take them off all these 24 out of the 27?
Oh, we did it in a very respectful way.
I see, just bit by bit.
bit by bit. And with each one we took her off of, her health improved.
Oh, God. Oh, man. I don't know why I should be surprised, right? Man. All right, Doc. Thanks so much. We sure enjoyed having you on the show.
It's a pleasure, Patrick. Anytime and a free consultation if they say your name.
And say it nicely, folks, when you say Patrick. 972-248-0780. Dr. Ross Stewart, brainandbodychemistry.com.
Brain and Body Wellness Center.
Oh, I'm sorry. Brain and Body Wellness Center. I got it. Brain and Body Wellness Center. Thanks, Doc. We'll see you soon.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. Dr. Ross Stewart, brainandbodywellnesscenter.com. Patrick Timpone, I love you all very much. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, and we will party.
From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.